cars in 10 Lidwood and Euclid, 10-5, there have men with rifles.
Saturday, March 29th. Two Detroit policemen investigate men with rifles leaving a church. What you're hearing is the actual police recording. Listen carefully as a wounded officer calls for help and cries in pain.
All units. All units. 10-5 needs help. Linwood and Euclid. Officer in trouble, Linwood and Euclid. All units, officer in trouble, Linwood and Euclid. They're shooting. Linwood and Euclid. Officer needs help, they're shooting at him.
The patrolman Richard Warabek, seriously wounded, but able to crouch on the floor of his squad car, operating the gas pedal by hand to get out of the line of fire. In front of the New Bethel Baptist Church, his partner, 22-year-old Michael Chopsky, lay dead. Help arrived fast. Other officers stormed the church building, spraying bullets ahead of them. Cowering inside, 147 men, women, and children. Fortunately, the fusillade wounded only four. There were mass arrests. The church had been the scene of a Republic of New Africa meeting, a separatist group maintaining an armed guard unit known as the Black Legion. Among those arrested, members of that militant guard. The event itself was tragic enough, but it was compounded in the early hours Sunday when Negro Judge George Crockett ordered the release of most of those arrested on constitutional grounds. Negro leaders denounced police for the church shoot-up. Council member Reverend Nicholas Hood keynoted it.
We deplore what went on outside of the church. We're only concerned here with what went on inside of the church. There is no condoning of this kind of activity on the part of any of us, but we're concerned that the house of God has just been indiscriminately shot up by somebody.
Officers maintained they shot into the church because they were fired upon. Later, Judge Crockett's courtroom was picketed as he steadfastly defended his actions.
If the killing had occurred in a white neighborhood, I believe the sequence of events would have been far different. Because a terrible crime was committed, it does not follow that other wrongs be permitted or condoned. Indeed, constitutional safeguards are needed even more urgently in times of tension than in ordinary times.
And Michael Chopsky was buried. The funeral, the largest in the history of the police department, as an already polarized community separated further. Some weeks later, charges were filed against a New Yorker, Rafael Vieira. He at first fought extradition, but finally returned to Detroit to maintain his innocence.
I was inside the church when the shooting started. I was outside first, and then I went inside the church, and all of a sudden I heard one loud bang, you know? And then all of a sudden I heard several other bangs. But then after a while I saw glass breaking, and I said, hold. So I started taking care of the women and children, pushing them down on the floor. Before I knew it, they were shooting in the windows.
Did you have a weapon that night, a gun? Or...
No, I didn't.
Were you then surprised when you were named?
When I found out about the warrant, I said, what's this?
You had no idea.
No, it took me back completely.
How did you first find out about the warrant?
I heard it over the radio, I believe.
Vieira's trial is yet to come. And despite the magnitude of the New Bethel Church incident, the black and white of Detroit had learned a costly lesson 2 years earlier. The efforts to live together increased, and no one worked harder to improve police-community relations than the top cop, Johannes Spreen. A man with a lifetime of police experience, he had taken over in 68, a task many had turned down. He was the great innovator. They called him Scooter Spreen when he introduced scooter patrols to build rapport with the citizenry. He called for a 100-day love-in, a cooling-off period to stop criticism of police and permit them to do their main job, fight crime. The public loved it. He was the poet policeman. Youngsters sent him valentines.
I think this is a very good thing, a gratifying thing to receive. On this big Valentine, it says, our cops are tops. It says, with love to the fuzz, have a successful love-in.
And Spreen wanted citizen participation.
Today, I'm announcing the answer, perhaps, to this year's most frequently asked question. What can I, as a citizen, do to help my police department? The answer is, buck up. your police department.
His appeal for dollars worked. More than 50,000 of them came in. But the commissioner had his political problems. There was an unsympathetic council that refused requests for more money and more police. He threatened to quit. And one youngster, 16-year-old Michael Benson, stated the concern many felt.
You're not really quitting, are you?
No, not as long as we can keep winning the battle or at least moving ahead a little bit. When, you know, if I move up 3 feet and drop back five, this is a problem. But if we move up 3 feet and drop back only two, well, we're gaining.
But the reign of Johannes Spreen was to end with that of outgoing Mayor Cavanaugh. The new mayor wanted his own man, and the commissioner, with charisma, bowed out philosophically.
When I accepted this position, my friends in New York said, not Detroit. And I've met the people here. This is a fine city with fine people. All it needs is a chance and a little luck. And as I leave my office, I say, why not Detroit?
Late in December, the mayor-elect picked his successor, Patrick Murphy, another veteran policeman, and oddly enough, once Spreen's boss. A quieter man, but again, an innovator.
Like all of the nation's cities, Detroit suffers from a serious crime problem. But hard work and dedication can generate and strengthen the citizen understanding, respect, and cooperation, which is necessary for the police to be more effective in controlling crime.
The incoming Murphy faces many difficulties, but perhaps the path has been paved.
Starting off with the first case, of course, we had a missing from Eastern Michigan. The second girl was from Eastern Michigan. The method of operation was...
This is Ann Arbor really Police Chief Walter Krasny. He's talking about murder. That, in this case, seven murders, all young women, all brutally killed, many molested, most from the campuses of the University of Michigan or nearby Eastern Michigan. Two of the killings dated back to 1967 and 68, but there were five between March 20th and July 26th of 1969. They were called the co-ed killings. A madman was on the loose, and fear gripped the Washtenaw County area. The police probe was confused. The victims had been found within the city and in outlying areas. Different agencies were handling the murders. At one point, Dutch psychic and entertainer Peter Herkos was brought in. He had been involved in the Boston Strangler case. Police did not invite him, but they did cooperate. And Herkos relished his moment in the limelight.
Very sick man. I have no respect for him.
Would it be a young man or an old man?
I'm after him. He's after me, I'm after him.
The Herkos visit proved nothing. Finally, the governor ordered state officials into the case, mainly to coordinate activities. Attorney General Kelly detailed the concern.
Your state government is taking every available step to help the professional law enforcement officers on the scene solve these horrible crimes and bring those responsible to justice.
One day later, an arrest was made. 23-year-old John Norman Collins, an Eastern Michigan senior, was charged with the killing of Karen Sue Beineman, the last victim. Ironically, police were led to Collins when his uncle, a state police corporal, noticed some oddities at his home. Collins had cared for a family dog during a vacation. Collins was a cycle enthusiast, was described as an all-American type, quiet, athletic, a good student. His friends were shocked.
He seemed like a nice guy, you know, trustworthy and everything. He didn't seem in any way strange, you know, or suspecting. It's just really hard to believe. It's really shocking that they think he's connected with this.
Collins goes on trial in 1970. He's charged with only the one murder, but there have been no unsolved co-ed killings since his arrest. Ann Arbor had other troubles during the year. It was June, and the so-called street people wanted a portion of Ann Arbor's South University Street closed to traffic and made into a mall. The powers that be said no, so the street people took over the street. Police had other ideas. There were several tense nights, some rock and bottle throwing, many injuries and arrests. But as it is with such incidents, it ended, and little more was heard. In the fall, again in Ann Arbor, it was a question of a bookstore. U of M students wanted a university-operated store with some student control. Book prices had become a problem, they said. The protesters took over a campus building, and University President Robin Fleming offered an opinion.
They're interested in great changes in society across the board, and this is simply a handy vehicle because they know there is considerable student interest in the subject of a bookstore.
In the end, using less militant tactics, the students won their fight. A university bookstore was to be. At other Michigan campuses, there were also problems. At Ferris State, troubled times when a black-white battle broke out. At Michigan State, Negro students took over a cafeteria. The incidents were short-lived. Nationwide, the issues varied. The tactics didn't. But the problems of education in Michigan mounted. Not only a matter of money, also of what to teach and how to teach it. The new governor laid out a massive and costly education reform program. Mr. Milliken emphasized it was time for action.
We can't have total reform with timid proposals. We can no longer continue the waste of human and financial resources which are now occurring in our outmoded educational system.
Included in the governor's billion-dollar package, aid to private and parochial schools, parochiaid. It had been and continued to be the center of controversy. The governor proposed including $25 million of state aid for private schools. The action brought long debate and intensive lobbying on both sides. And then there was the testy issue of sex education. Should it be taught, and if so, how? No single problem raised more furor. The State Board of Education scheduled a series of public hearings on the issue, and those that opposed did so without reservation.
I haven't been to a movie in 10 years because they're all so filthy. And you know, I just woke up about this junk. And when I read Rosemary's Baby, I saw the connection here. Do you know our school board is teaching the religion of the devil and immorality?
One victim of the sex education battle, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Dr. Ira Polly. He had okayed certain materials for use in those schools offering such courses, but without Board of Education approval. He came under fire and finally resigned. In the world of business, a longtime auto executive got the axe. Seaman Knudsen was dismissed as president of the Ford Motor Company. He had left General Motors a year before in what was considered a coup for Ford. That romance ended in September.
As an experienced businessman, I'm puzzled by this sudden and unexpected action. Until September 2nd, I was looking forward to a long-term happy relationship with a company where I enjoyed both my associates and my work.
Said Henry Ford II, it just didn't work out.
He certainly has had tremendous experience in the automobile business, and I felt that we could use the kinds of experience that he'd had. When I say it didn't work out, isn't that clear? We just didn't work.
Miss Michigan had some luck. She became Miss America. Pam Eldred had been on the beauty circuit before, but the top prize led Women's Wear Daily to question her mental involvement. In fact, they termed the new Miss America a goody two-shoes. The Queen didn't care.
I know that they didn't like me or didn't care for me, and I felt bad that, you know, when people don't like you, but everybody has their own opinion. And I just hope throughout the year that I can change this opinion that they have of me.
One of the year's unusual confrontations came in all-white Dearborn, where longtime mayor Orville Hubbard, a man whose conservative views left few questions, met Reverend Ralph Abernathy of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It appeared Mayor Hubbard was softening.
Well, how are you, sir?
I'm Mayor Hubbard. Thank you.
Delighted to meet you,
Thank
Mr.
You.
Mayor. Pleasure to come to your city.
Fellows just asked me today, they said, would you like to have Mr. Abernathy to live here? I said, we sure would.
Well, it may be that when I finish solving the problems of the South and of the nation and putting an end to poverty, I'll retire here and do it.
Thank you. I think you're doing a good job.
Some voices were stilled in 69. Among them, Irene Castle and Nicky Hilton. Thelma Ritter and Charles Wininger, Ralph McGill and Drew Pearson, Everett McKinley Dirksen and Dwight David Eisenhower, Dr. Philip Blyberg and Philip Barnum, Judy Garland and Sonia Haney, Walter Hagen, Rocky Marciano, Tony Pastor and Russ Morgan, Robert Taylor and Boris Karloff. Frank Lesser and Frank Clement, Reverend James Pike and Levy Eshcole, and Ho Chi Minh, Joseph P. Kennedy and Judge Thomas J. Murphy, John L. Lewis, John Shada, and Leroy Augenstein. As in all years, there were other deaths. A storm named Camille killed 300. A 9-day rain in California led to 91 deaths, and tornadoes took their toll. 24 Americans died when the carrier Melbourne collided with the destroyer Evans. And Americans persisted in continuing that mass slaughter on the highways. But the bright moments were many. Picture a conservative vice president with a 13-year-old daughter who wants to participate in a moratorium day. Mrs. Agnew remembered it.
Wanted to wear a black armband because some of her schoolmates were going to wear black armbands. And finally, she had a discussion with her father and myself as to what the moratorium was all about. And she even asked what the history in Vietnam was. She was a little unhappy because she couldn't wear the black armband but like the rest of her classmates were going to do, but she abided by our wishes. And another day's time, she was playing her Beatle records backwards to find out whether Paul McCartney had left a message or not.
What Kim Agnew listened for, a clue to the McCartney mystery. Was he dead or alive? To some, the Beatles played backwards didn't really sound much different than the Beatles played forward. To others, there was a message in it. They searched symbolic album covers, listened to recordings in reverse and at various speeds. But it all ended happily. Paul, his wife, and child were in Scotland, alive and well and rich. Record sales were never better. Other events and names of 1969 were myriad. What was called a happening happened in mid-August. It was Woodstock, billed as a music and art fair. An all-star cast of the top rock artists lured more than 400,000 youngsters to a New York farm. Youth got together, and America took notice. An archbishop was elevated. He became John Cardinal Dearden. There was a new hijacking record, 6,900 miles, a circuitous route from Fresno to Rome. In France, De Gaulle lost and left. Two accused assassins were convicted. Saran Saran faces the gas chamber in California. James Earl Ray, 99 years in Tennessee. For Clay Shaw, an acquittal in New Orleans. In Michigan, a self-proclaimed mafia songbird sang some funny tunes. Some listened, most didn't. Drugs caused more concern than ever. There were problems for Black Panthers. In New Jersey, a crackdown on crime and some officials were officially charged. In Hollywood, Sharon Tate and others met murder, and arrests brought out a bizarre tale of a modern-day Svengali. In Northern Ireland, a religious war raged, and Arabs and Israelis continued to fight. Dr. Spock and friends won in court, while a colonel named Riolt never made it. General Hershey moved aside, by request, and in Washington, Lady Bird, Linda Bird, and Lucy were replaced by Pat and Tricia and Julie. There were cyclamates, and then there were not. There was a black manifesto and money demands. There was a merger for Hudson's and Dayton's. A deserter named Sinkovich in a church sanctuary. John Sinclair with a long prison term for marijuana. At Michigan State, a new president named Wharton. At Michigan, a new coach named Bo and a victory over the unbeaten for all the Roses. There was no repeat for the Tigers. It was the year of the Jets and the Mets, of Namath and Seaver, of Andretti and Granatelli and Orville Moody. There was a Michigan Golf Classic with no purse, a sophomore named Haywood who turned pro. There was the resurgence of the Lions and some bitter goodbyes from Gadsby and Sane. And there was a wedding, when Miss Vicky became Mrs. Tim. And so it was, not just another year, rather another decade. A decade of dissent and discovery. A chaotic period of protest and revolt. We sent men to the moon and back, but couldn't learn to live with each other. A 10-year excursion has ended and passed to its place among the things that were. What we remember and what we forget may determine what lies ahead. For WKNR News, I'm Philip Nye.